There was a cut after a long scene. He gave the camera, went on his knees, and he was weeping, weeping like a child. This movie made me realize on set the amount of traumas that I never dealt with in my life.
Ooh. Surely you remember the story of Hind Rajab, the 5-year-old Palestinian girl whose killing by the Israeli army shocked the world. This all happened in January 2024. Hind and 6 of her relatives were fleeing Gaza City when an Israeli tank opened fire on their car. Now, Hind survived the initial attack, trapped among her family's bodies, and she spent 3 hours on her phone with paramedics and her mother, begging for help. The ambulance sent to rescue her was then struck, killing the 2 paramedics inside. And it would take 12 days before paramedics and others were able to reach the site and recover the bodies of Hind and her relatives. Now, a new film, The Voice of Hind Rajab, brings the story to the screen, centering Hind's final call with emergency responders and the Palestine Red Crescent. Now, the critically acclaimed film has already won awards, drawn Oscar buzz, and received a 23-minute standing ovation at the Venice Film Festival. One of its stars is Mu'taz Malhis, an actor from Jenin in occupied Palestine, and is widely regarded as one of the most talented Palestinian actors of his generation. So today I speak to Mu'taz about his role in The Voice of Hind Rajab and what his experience means for both art and reality. My name is Mohammed Hashim, and this is Real Talk. Mu'taz Malhis, thank you so much for coming on Real Talk. It's such a pleasure to be speaking to you today.
Thank you for having me. It's such an honor to be with you.
No, yes. Thank you, Mu'taz. Mu'taz, I'm just going to start off right away. And I think the audience has gotten, you know, the story of the film and what it centers in the introduction. But I want to go to you with this. Usually when actors receive a script for a film, you know, they read it, they process it, they engage with it. But when you get a script like this one, how did you kind of start your reading process or just processing the whole thing in general?
Oh, the script. Look, I've read so many scripts that I have acted in and I did not act in. And I've never read a script where I couldn't stop crying.
Couldn't stop crying.
Yeah. Like, I remember my tears literally dripping on the script. And I was like, oof. Like, I was like, really, you know, I got the script, I got the role. I was like, with 2 brains thinking, like, is it the time to do a film about the genocide while the genocide is going on? And the second question is, like, after you start reading the script, you understand how important this story to be told right now. It's just like, you feel like, can I do it? Especially that what's going on right now in Palestine and Gaza especially didn't stop yet. So during the filming, I'm filming and I'm going to be like filming, but the genocide is still running. But in the same time, you think like, what can you do? Will you sit at home and just keep watching? Or will you do some action about it?
Just to ask you about that little note, because I find it interesting. So you're asking yourself, is this a time to do a film as a genocide is unfolding or is ongoing?
Yeah.
And you find, or at least during that moment, you were trying to debate if it was worth it or not. Did you find an issue of participating in a work of art during this time?
I kind of hesitate. But once you read the script, you go like, this story should be told right now. Like now, you can't just wait because you never know when it will stop. And you need to do your part. Like, because if you're just an artist I'm going to sit and do my Romeo and Juliet and that's it, which is amazing. It's beautiful. But we need to care more about the humanity. We need to care more about the future of our children. So that's one of the reasons why I was like, I want to do it. And to work with Kauthar was a dream for me. But sadly, it came with this project. Like, it's a heartbreaking project. It's a strong film to be shown to the world. You feel big responsibility. There was a moment for me where I want to call the director and say, like, look, I can't do this.
During filming or during the script reading?
During script reading. I was like about to do that. And I was like, I sat with myself for hours. It's like, because it's not, this is not a normal story. This is like, we're talking about a child, 5, 6 years old. And she got killed in the most brutal way, the way you see it, the way you investigate about it. You, all the documents shows you like something you like, so hard to even read, not just to watch. But in the same time, you think about the responsibility and the duty toward your people or toward the humanity in general. And you say like, I know this will destroy me emotionally, big time, but it's a must to do. I should do it. Because I always think like, if not us, who will come and do it for us? Well, so that's one of the reasons why I was like, I must do it.
Did you feel added weight because of your Palestinian background?
Of course. Because this movie made me realize on set the amount of traumas that I never dealt with in my life.
Ooh.
It literally...
That's very tough to hear, by the way.
Yeah, it's I never really dealt with my childhood or the way I grew up in Palestine. You don't realize the traumas until you are like, I moved 4 years ago to London. And before that, I've toured, I've run the world, I performed many places, but I never settled down to really look at what's going on in my country from far away. That the first time in my life started just 4 years ago, and I started to realize all the flashbacks of my childhood, especially this with this movie, it just sent me back to my childhood. Like, it's like kind of flashback, my childhood. When I say when I was a child, in 2002, there was a massive invasion in the West Bank, especially
during
the
Second Intifada.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you just were surrounded with army, with bombs, with guns, with shooting, with the tanks and jeeps and Apaches and helicopters and all kind of these things.
And so, for context, you grew up in the Jenin refugee camp.
No, I grew up in the west side of Jenin, which is in a village in there, and I'm like literally 5 minutes away from an Israeli military base where they train there.
So you weren't even in the refugee camp when this happened. You were actually outside of it, and still you got to witness all the violence.
Like when the invasion happened, it wasn't just in the Jenin refugee camp.
Sure.
The Jenin refugee camp got the most brutal way of this, like the way they destroyed it, the way they killed people in there. But the army was all around. It wasn't just in Jenin refugee camp. It was in every place around Jenin. Like I'm like 7 minutes away from the camp. I'm not that far. Like in the car, 7 minutes, you are in the camp. 5 minutes, 4 minutes of driving, you are next to the military base. So you grow up with this environment and you think this is the normal until you start seeing what's going on. You understand this is like a non-stop trauma. It's like you might leave, you may never come back. This is the reality. And I've witnessed and I've seen a lot. But I never really sat down to deal with it. And sitting on set and doing this movie and hearing a child begging to be rescued, there where I realized, whoa, that's reminding me of a lot of things from my childhood that I never really sat down to deal with.
And what was your train of thought once you came to that realization? Like, once you thought of it right away, what happened to you?
I was like, like shocked from myself, like why I never seeked like a therapist or somebody to talk to about all of these things that have been hidden inside my guts. And till now, I haven't like really, I don't feel like sometimes like I'm going to bed and I still hear her voice. Even when I'm walking the street, I could hear her voice in my ear. Yeah. Especially sometimes while I'm sleeping, I also hear her voice in my dreams. It's hard to feel powerless. It's so hard. It's not an easy feeling. That's you hearing a child begging to be rescued again. Like, this is not an easy thing. Like, even if you are made, your emotion is made out of iron, you will melt. Because the way I see children, I see them as angels. Children shouldn't be harmed. Doesn't matter where they came from or who their parents are or whatsoever. You know, I mean, children are children. Like, that's the way I see it.
You know, there's something here that I kind of want to unpack. We're going to talk about everything else in a second. But what you touched on just a minute ago about not coming to terms with your trauma or not realizing the trauma or facing it for the first time, I think this shows so much. There's a lot to be said here about the plight of the Palestinian people, because I'll give you an example. I have a friend who's a photojournalist. He's a journalist who was in Gaza at the beginning of the genocide, and he was there for about a year or so covering it, right, nonstop. And then he managed to get out, and we met not too long ago, and I was having a conversation with him, and I remember he was still, you know, on his phone and reporting and updating and putting out news reports and all of that. And I'm like, why don't you just take a minute? I asked him, I was like, why can't you just take a minute to just rest or just have a bit of time for yourself? And his immediate response to me really shocked me, or really put things into a lot of perspective in ways that I've never thought about. He said, you know, the hardest time for me and other Palestinian journalists in Gaza was when there was a short ceasefire, because then we had to actually face the amount of killing and the destruction. And he's like, when I'm working and when I'm consistently kind of dialed in is how I can function the most. As soon as I have a little bit of free time, I become a wreck, because then I realize what has actually happened. And I think what you were saying kind of reminded me of that conversation. And I think a lot of Palestinians can relate to what you're saying, whether they're from Gaza or from the West Bank or wherever they're from.
That applies also the same thing on the people who works at the Red Crescent. When I was investigating the story from my side, like, you know, you have the director, she'd done like a great investigation about the whole story through organizations, through the Red Crescent, through Hind's family. But I, you know, as an actor, it comes to you as a responsibility to do your own investigation after all the amount of information you got. Sure. One of the things that was surprising me, like, I was super surprised. I was like, wow, when I heard about it. The people who work at the Red Crescent, sometimes to distract themselves, they play games on their phones. It might sound crazy, but that's kind of an escape for them to keep distracted and to like to control their emotions, because those the people who work in the Red Crescent on like on a phone call center, they receive thousands of calls. And literally, they are talking with people who are like 1 minute, 2 minutes, 10 minutes, 1 hour away from being dead. And when I heard about it, and it's in the movie, there is this part where like the role I play, Omar Alkam, which is, he's an amazing human being. Like, he's my amazing friend now.
I heard you say this in an interview. You said you think, because you've spoken to him so much, you actually felt like you destroyed him. I heard you say a comment along those lines.
So when he mentioned that to me about the gaming, I was like, whoa, Omar, this is... He said, Mataz, what can I do? Like, if I don't do this, I'll be destroyed fully and I can't serve. And this is the kind of weird, like when I tell it to people, like they go like, are you working or playing? I'm working, but I use this as distraction. I'm not dealing with people who are like had like a small thing in their life, a small accident. I'm talking with people who are surrounded with bombs, with rockets. So it's emotionally, it's so hard. And yeah, back when I did the investigation with him, he told me many things. But the moment I started asking him the first day, he told me, look, I'm going to call you like in half an hour. And he disappeared because I was so worried to ask him questions because like opening the wounds for him. Sure. Like he's trying to run away and keep working, but it's still like he can't run away from it. And I ask him these questions when I want to ask him, not because I want to open the wounds for him. It's because I want to portray him in the best way, in the best way I can as an artist, as an actor, because he's the real hero for me, the way I look at it. He's and the guys at the Red Crescent, the people who work in the ambulances, they go in to rescue people all time, and they might never come back. So for me, those are real heroes. So I'm not going to just portray him based on my information and that's it. And that's why I dig deep. And we decided with the director that we're going to go investigate also with the real people, that, because we want to honor them. You're not just making a role from a fictional world. You are doing a role based on a real person. And that is a big responsibility. And I hope I put my heart to it. Me and the cast and the director and everyone on set, we did our like best to deliver the story. So, yeah.
What is the thing, if there's just a one thing, let's say, or an example of something that Omar told you that hasn't escaped you, or something that you consistently continue to think about?
After the first conversation, he disappeared and he came back like after 24 hours or 48 hours, I can't remember. But from that moment, we clicked and we became really close, and we are literally talking every week since that time. Hopefully, I'm going to see him also in November. The one thing that's, I can't forget it at all, like Omar, when that happened that day and what happened with Hint. And Omar had many calls similar to Hint's, many, like uncountable maybe. But because Hint stayed on the line for hours and they thought, they believed they can rescue her. He told me like when he got home that day, he couldn't talk to anyone from the family at all. And it took him 3 to 4 months to hold his own baby. And that wasn't like when you tell me like about your own flesh, like your own son. He couldn't. He told me, I don't know, my body, my things, like it was. I was so scared. All I was thinking about is, what can I do for those children? And like, look, we've done everything. We got the green light. We worked on it so hard. And in the end, you know the result. And when he told me that, I was like, I had goosebumps. I felt like something is killing me. Like, you're talking about your own son. I told him, he said, yeah. Not that I couldn't hold him. I couldn't like really play with him or do anything for 3-4 months. And that tells you also back to the traumas that's, because in there, it's not a trauma, like post-trauma. It's a life trauma.
It's not post, like exactly.
It's on a loop.
Yeah.
You never really, you don't have the time to sit down, to grieve, to cry. You don't have the time. And I always say we need just a time. Give us like a break. Like we want to sit down and cry and grieve like any human being, because this is our bare minimum, right? But when, if it's not stopping, when are you gonna have the time to grieve and to do something about it? It feels like sometimes some of us are like, they're blocked from the inside. They're losing, but there is like the emotion is blocked because they didn't have even the time like to really sit down and weep over it. Yeah, one of the things is this, like he couldn't hold his own son for like 3-4 months. And that's not fair for any human being.
And then if we take it now to you've decided to you know, back to what we were saying. So now you've decided to make the movie. You've read the script. You've decided to do it. And one of the things that the director, Kawthar bin Haneya, one of the things that got some media coverage or media attention was the fact that in the film, she basically kind of forbade or kind of blocked you and the cast from listening to Hind's voice until you actually were filming.
Yeah.
Just to give it a kind of this, I guess, this real reaction to hearing Hind's voice for the first time. Can you talk to me about that?
I knew it would be hard.
Yeah.
But it's way harder than what I thought.
It was harder than what you thought.
Yeah. Because there was some moment like, first of all, we were like listening to parts by parts, like on action, only in the scene. You hear only the scene. You're not going to hear the whole thing because she knew how sensitive is that. The director is like, I'm like sending Kawthar all of my love. She's a genius director and she's a great human being. But she knew like it's not going to be an easy thing like to sit down and like making like a listening session. Like this is not a normal, like so literally the whole record is about a child begging and you're trying to distract this child like to make them feel safe as much as you can in hope that the ambulance reaches there and saves her. So first time I heard actually her cousin, which is Leanne.
Leanne, yeah.
And I know the record. But on set, I felt like I'm literally on the phone with her. And the more you hear it, the more you feel like something is killing you from the inside. You're dying. I felt like literally on set, I felt like I'm dying. I'm like dying every moment. Like thousand time of like you die and you reborn and you die in the same moment again and again and again and it's going on loop. There was some moment I couldn't carry on. I asked to just stop. My body was shaking like that and I panic attacks. I couldn't stop crying because there was like literally one time where I felt I hold the actor Amr Hlehel and I told him, bro, please, can we just stop? Let's just go outside. I feel my heart gonna explode. Wow. And I'm not saying this is like as a mythologic thing.
No,
it's
this
not.
Is real.
This is like, that's how I felt.
Yeah.
I felt my heart gonna explode. And there was some moment where I took a break for a long time, for 40 minutes, like because my body couldn't stop shaking. It's not something like you can control. And that's when I tell you about like, maybe that movie made me realize the amount of traumas that I never dealt with. So for me or for anyone in the cast, it wasn't an easy thing to hear her voice. There's even, I remember on the first day, there was, we started because we were filming from A to Z, scene by scene. We were not filming from the middle and coming back. No, it was like
chronological.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember the DOP, our cinematographer, the DOP, Juan Saramento. He's an amazing, amazing DOP. He's from Colombia. And he said, I'm grateful to be here, but there's something that I feel a bit special, that I don't understand Arabic. And it's such a hard story to listen to it. So it's going to be less heavy for me than you. Mm. And I was like, yeah, maybe it's a good thing that you didn't speak Arabic. And trust me, from the first day, he was like, when I remember, like he was filming everything freehand on his shoulders. From the first few hours, like there was a cut after a long scene. He gave the camera, went on his knees, and he was weeping like a child. And you look around you, there was like the majority of the people who work in Gunset, they were Arab people, Palestinians and Tunisians mainly. There's like maybe 5% who are non-Arabs. But everyone on set, the boom operator, like the gaffer, everyone, you look at the DOP, but you look around, everyone is like, it's not an easy story. Even if you don't understand the language.
Sure.
Like I was like, in my head, I was like, yeah, it makes sense what he's saying, Juan. It's not going to maybe affect him the same as it's going to affect us. But I think it did affect every one of us on the same level. And there was no escape for any, even if you don't understand the language.
So when you watch it back, when you watch the film back and you look at yourself, what is it that you think? How much do you feel like is acting, and how much is actually you reacting like a real reaction? And like, what was your thought process when you saw it back on the big screen?
I was proud and honored to be part of this story. Like, if I'm being realistic, there is like also the comes to the actor in you. Sometimes we are actors, we don't like ourselves on the screen. But I can't deny the amount of truth in there, in the performance. So, because I'm telling you that, like, there is like just commitment in this film from everyone of us. So I didn't feel like even I was like acting, I was like living it. I believed for one moment that I can save her.
You believe that you could save her?
Yeah. I swear that's what I, like, my head just was in that direction, and I'm gonna save this girl, whatever it takes. But then you realize the reality is not like the same thing. And sometimes me as an actor, I believe in my imagination and I dive in it. I forgot about the reality. And maybe it's something good, because like that's one of the reasons why I act, because I want to achieve things that I can't achieve in reality. So at least I can achieve them in my imagination. Because there's some things that you feel like you are powerless, you can't change them. But you try. You try your best. You do everything you can in hope to have this change.
Well, Tess, why did you feel like you wanted to become an actor? I mean, you've been acting since you were about 9 years old, right? Since you were a child.
It started when a friend of mine got killed next to me. And before that, I thought it's like when you see children throwing rocks at the jeeps and the tanks, and you think it's a game. But then they realize when somebody got killed next to you, you go like, oh, wait, this is not a game.
That's how it started for you?
Yeah, and I wanted to just to take Amir's story to the world, to tell them, like, there's nothing justified the way they killed him. Like, they shot him in the
head. You said his name is Amir?
Yeah, his name is Amir Shawahni. He's from my village. And he was around 11, 12, same age as me, a bit older. Grew up in the same village. And there where I realized, oh, wait, actually, this is scary. He's gone. And there where I was like, I was, you know, it took me time to understand what happened, like months. But then I was like, oh, okay, I believe I can tell the story at least. Just to talk about what's happening to my people. Because I never believed, like, my personal opinion, like guns or anything like that is going to change anything. But maybe I can do a change with my art. And from that moment, and I carried on, like... I studied at the Freedom Theater, ran away from the high school when I was 15 and a half. My family discovered later big problems between me and them. No, you should go study as a doctor or as an engineer or as this and that. And I was like, no, doesn't matter. I'm going to study theater. That's it. And since that age, I start to tour around the world with the Freedom Theater and then other companies. And I still have, I hope I will also have the same morals with me.
Morals.
And I will carry on in the same way, because I act to make a change. I don't act to be under the spotlight. I don't act for being seeking fame, or it's beautiful, nice, but this is materialistic stuff. If I can't do a change as an artist, there is no point of my art. Like, I want to make something for the world. I don't want to just make something just to do it. That's it. Doesn't make sense for me. It needs to have a purpose, needs to have why am I doing this. So yeah, that's how it started.
You're saying about wanting to make a change. So then how did you react when you were in Venice during the film festival, and then you saw the you know, you're part of this 23-minute standing ovation that so many outlets covered? How was that moment for you?
It's goosebumps. It's you feel like there's pride, and you feel grateful and honored also, But at the same time, all I was thinking in my mind, like literally was one thought in my head, is that going to do anything about what's happening back home?
So that was
And this question is still all the time in my mind. Am I doing the right things?
Because let me just interject here, Montez, because maybe anyone else in your position, you know, as an actor who, you know, you've come from a country that's not in the West, you come from Palestine, and then now you're in Venice, and you're a major film festival around the world. You have A-listers around you, right? You have Joaquin Phoenix giving you a hug, and you have all these big names that are there. And so I find it interesting, or maybe others will find it interesting as well, how you're kind of thinking about that particular moment. Is that despite all of this, the glam and the paparazzi, let's say, and the cameras and all of that and the big names, you're still thinking about what's happening in your own country or back home?
Yeah. Nothing in the world can make you just get off thinking about it.
And I'm not faulting you for it at all. No, I know. I'm saying, I think for any aspiring actor, this would have been such a top moment.
Which is amazing. It was true. It should be. It should be this way. But which is like, I told you at the beginning, like sadly.
Absolutely.
You know what, sadly, when you're doing this project and you feel, but in the same time, you feel the responsibility. If you're asking me, I would love to do Romeo and Juliet. I would love to do different stuff, beautiful, like about freedom, peace, and music. But during this time, I can't do these things. I can't do these things while I know, and you know, and everyone knows what's going on.
Of course.
And don't misunderstand me, the standing ovation, the awards, like leaving Venice with 9 awards in there. One of them is major one, the Grand Jury Prize. It is a big honor. We are grateful for it. It's amazing. But there is something always in your head, like, is this genocide gonna stop? I'm like, the people back home, they are really tired, exhausted. Like, till when? Are they going to wipe all of us? You think about all of these things, and you just think about, like, what is your duty in here? What you need to do? What can you do? What can you really do and push on it also? And my answer is that's art. That's what I can do. This is my part. And I hope if I have other things to do, and I try to help in many different places, and I hope I'm doing something. And that's all I'm like. You still feel with myself, I'm saying, like, you still feel guilty. Am I doing enough? Because it's like, as long as it's running, you're going to feel like you wake up, you sleep, you go to bed, you're sitting to eat, and you're looking at the news, and like, it just destroying you mentally. And I can't like say, I don't want to watch, I don't want to see. That's my home. That's my people. It's me. I was born and raised there also. And if I was not, still the human in me wouldn't say like, oh, I can't watch it. No, I need to know what's going on. And I need to do something about it.
What were the conversations that you were having? I'm sure you've run into several of these celebrities, of these big stars. And what was the nature of the conversations you were having kind of away from the cameras?
You know, even those actors or artists, they see the movie. It takes them so long to process.
It takes them so long to process.
Yeah. You meet them with silence. They say what a great film, what a great performance, all of this, but you feel like they can't dig deep into it because their brain is still processing. Like, you go into the room, you know, normally some people, they bring popcorn to watch and to sit and we laugh. But in this movie, you keep like, you watch it like that.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, there is big tension building and you're just waiting to see what will happen on loop. So there was the conversation, most of them, they're proud of what we're doing. If I'm talking in general, there's a lot of amazing artists who are like, they are against the genocide. They are doing a lot. They're standing against it, and they're not like just saying it for like just saying it. They say it in the media, they say it on their platforms.
The reason why I ask you that question is because, you know, you're starting to read a lot and here there's a lot of there's this rhetoric that about a narrative that's changing, right? Let's say if there's a narrative war, if there's a culture war inside Hollywood, let's say, you're starting to read and listen more to this conversation about the government of Israel actually losing that culture war inside Hollywood, let's say. And so I ask you that question to see if that was the sentiment that you got out of it. Did you feel like there was a changing narrative in the way people spoke to you?
It's not just Hollywood, like the whole world. It's the whole world is changing because they are like, I think this is kind of the, like, you are not kind of, you are watching a life live on your phone, on your screen. So there is no way to deny it. When you wake up and you sleep and you watch children in pieces, women, men, like, destroyed buildings, like, to the ground. Some places, some areas are destroyed to the ground. It's like, you can't just look at it and say, this is like, oh, this is fine or normal. It's like, the human in you will refuse that. Any normal human being will refuse that. And it's the whole world is watching what's going on. You see in the streets, you see in like everything. You see, we both are watching the news. The people are like fed up. They want that to stop.
Mm.
And each one of us, they do their part. Some people in politics, some people in art, some people like in acting, some people in painting, some people in music, some people in journalism. You know, each one of us have their part to participate and to do something for the sake of humanity. So if everyone is like, the people are like, they start to realize what's going on in Palestine, most of the people around the world, just the last 2 years. Not because of the media, it's because of the social media.
Yeah. There's a scene in the film, Voice of Hindraja, where it's your character, Omar. It's like your character, Omar, is having an argument with Mehdi, who's his superior.
Yeah.
In the film. And you're arguing for why can't we get the ambulance to Hind right away? And he's telling you, no, you need to speak to the Red Cross and you need to speak to COGAT. And COGAT is a unit in the Israeli military which has administrative affairs in occupied Palestine. But basically, he's telling you there is a process here that needs to be done.
Yeah.
And your character is saying, this is something that should be so much more simpler. The ambulance is only a few minutes away and it could just take a few minutes for the drivers to get there. Now, the reason I ask you this is because I wanted to see if this basically taught you anything about the reality that Palestinians in Gaza are facing right now amid the genocide, because I think it's such a strong scene which showcases the impossible conditions that have been created by the Israeli military amid this genocide. And this is what everyday Palestinians face in their lives there.
First of all, it's not just through this genocide. This thing has been happening for long.
Mm.
When the army are in an area and somebody got shot, you need to coordinate. You can't just get the ambulance that easy.
Yes.
You need to coordinate, which is anywhere on earth, an ambulance shouldn't call or say, I'm going to save somebody. Like, I'm sure, like, there is medical staff, there is ambulances in many places in the world that they got bombed. This is not just, it doesn't happen just only in Palestine. It happens in other places in the world. But still, it shouldn't happen. It shouldn't happen for any ambulance to call and say, like, oh, there is somebody, I need to go rescue, somebody's bleeding. It doesn't make sense in your head. Ambulance should have like a green light for saving people. That's what I learned when I studied medical aid when I was a child. And that's what's in the books also says that an ambulance is there to save people. You can't stop an ambulance for going to save people. So, but Omar is like, he represents kind of the young generation in Palestine, and he's new that time in the Red Crescent. So for him, like, he doesn't understand what's the protocol. Somebody's dying on the phone. Do anything to save them. And Mahdi is like, for him, he's been working there for years and years, and he's the CEO, and he can't just rescue the team because he knows the result. If he just tell them, yeah, go without the green light, they're going to be killed. So that's the... There was that kind of fire between Omar and Mahdi.
Yeah.
Because Omar wants to do it, doesn't matter what it takes. Mm. And Mahdi, he wants to protect the team.
Yeah.
Because he lost so many people. And he says, in the real story and in the movie, that if I lose this team, I'm leaving. I'm leaving that. I'm not going to work at the Red Cross. I'm just going. And he did. He said, I'm not going to risk any more people. I'm done with this. He can't. He can't just like deal with it mentally, because he got the green light, and in the end, the result was the same. They bombed the ambulance, they killed the girl. So there's like, Omar and Mahdi are so different in the movie.
Mm.
And this is based on reality also. That's the real characters are like this. For me, because I grew up in Palestine, I know the deal that you need to coordinate, but I didn't know about like, oh, there is a unit called COGAT, to be honest. I didn't know like, oh, there's a specific unit, and like those details that's been built also by the director. It's just like she explains for you. This is what happens. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And that shows you how much she cares about to tell the story, about how much she really investigated inside the story to represent it in the most... Yeah, like in a great way, in a strong way, and without adding anything. Just keep it as it is. She didn't add anything. Everything that's in the movie, that what happened that day.
Did you have a chance to speak to or interact with Hind's relatives, like her mother? Because I've heard Hind's mother give an interview about the film. Mm-hmm. Obviously, understandably, she said that she can't watch it. She isn't able to watch it. She doesn't, you know, I don't think it's something that she wants to do. But she has expressed a lot of support for the cast and for the filmmakers around this project. And I'm just wondering if you had a chance to interact with any of Hind's relatives.
First of all, I want to just mention that without Wissam Rajab, we couldn't have done the movie. Like she need to give the permission for this. So Kawthar built an amazing friendship with Wissam, and she showed her everything, what are we going to do from A to Z, and she got the permit, and from there she started the process, because like you can't just go make a movie about a child whose his family are still there that time and just do it like this. This is like, it's kind of dehumanization. It's like a disrespect for the family. You need to have a permit from the family. It's like you want to honor the child. You need to have the permission, because you can't just do it and without asking. Maybe some films that could happen this way without asking a family, but not in this film. No, I never talked to Wissam, but I talked to her uncle, like Hind's uncle, Ihab. Ihab, he's a good friend now. We chat a lot. We've been chatting a lot. And he's an amazing guy. He's been so helpful. I could talk to Wissam, but I don't know what to say. I don't know if you understand me, but it's going to be so hard. I'm sure I will. I'm sure later on I will speak to her, and I would be so honored. But it's not an easy thing to have a conversation with the, like with Omar it was hard, with her uncle it was hard. Like you're talking about her mom.
Yeah.
I don't think it's an easy thing. Like any question I'm gonna say or any comment is gonna be like, it's gonna just like, cut deep. I try to not having the conversation, because I know what's going to be the result. It's going to be tears and tears and tears and more depression. And she like, they said, her family said like, now they hopefully they are safe and they survived. But still like, you can't just erase the past and what happened. to the family. There were like other six members from Hind's family in the car who got also killed.
Yeah.
So no one ever talked to her.
I want to also ask you, Mataz, about how you see your life right now since the moment you stopped, you wrapped filming on this film, you wrapped up to the press tour till the moment that you and I are sitting together right now. How are you looking back at this stage in your life?
I don't know. I'm telling you, like, I'm grateful, I'm proud I've done this. But I kind of not thinking about myself. I'm thinking about the movie to reach to everyone in the world. Everyone needs to see it the way I see it. Like, I hope everyone have the courage and to go really open their hearts and watch the movie. But I was not thinking about myself. Like, many people are telling me, like, the role you did, the performance you did, this is like, it's going to change all your career. But inside of me, like, I go like, okay, that's great, but that was not my intention, you know? But I can't deny, like, this is the compliments that I'm getting from producers, directors, actors who've been seeing the movie. I'm getting messages and emails and every day about my performance. You feel grateful, but in this, like, literally all you're thinking about, like, thank you, I love that, and it warms my heart. But the little Mataz inside of me is just saying, like, I just want the genocide to stop. I don't want to think about myself right now. If I'm being honest, like, I want this to stop. Then about my future, about my career, then we talk about it. I will think about it. But while this happening, that you can't find, like, you can't really sit and celebrate even the success we've done. Cinema-wise, I'm talking.
Sure, yeah.
It doesn't make sense. You know what I mean? It's like, you're not, you. This film is grief, it's genocide. It's.
But how do you balance this, Mataz? It's such a hard thing that you're talking about.
Yeah, I know, but I'm like, I have no celebration till now. I don't feel like I can go, yeah, we did this. No, because it's not stopping it. You can't. Like, that's the way I see it. Like, I didn't feel like, you know, normally, like, when you win awards, you go throw up a big party and you celebrate and, like, you'd be, like, all over talking about it. But in with this film, like, you go silently, you go, like, I'm grateful and I'm honored. But, like, the celebration itself, like, celebrate about what? Exactly, like, doesn't make sense, you know what I mean?
But do you not feel like this is kind of part of, let's say, your sense of mission, having a mission or having a purpose, just taking these kind of projects, perhaps?
Yeah, it's part of it, yeah. I told you why I started acting, exactly. So maybe next movie gonna be something, some happiness in it, I don't know. Then I'll celebrate and you'll see me, like, reacting in a different way. But it's still, like, also, like, awards are great. It is, like, any actor, any director would be happy to get awards. Mm. It's a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I will be grateful all the time for these things, but I never acted for these things.
Right.
And that's why maybe, like, I got nice critiques talking about me and my performance, because maybe that's not my intention and my focus. My intention, my focus is to serve the story as much as I can. Like, even in this, especially this movie, it's other movies you feel like, oh, I'm like a star and all of this and that, but keep it humble is the most important thing. Keep your feet on the ground. But in this movie, every one of us was thinking how to serve the story, not how to come on set as a star. There was no vibe like this. I felt like a family. I felt so much trust between us, so much love, so much care. And every single person on set, from the director to the person who taking care of us, making coffee and food for us, to the cast, to the producers, to everyone, everyone is coming with a humble heart and with responsibility and with a duty and with love and care and respect. And there was so much freedom for us there. The director, she just created an amazing atmosphere inside the set.
We were talking about the success of the film just a minute or two ago, and this is something that I'm thinking about, and it'd be interesting to get your thoughts on it. Obviously, as you know, there's already Oscar buzz for this film. Mm-hmm. It's been already submitted by Tunisia. Mm-hmm. But the reason why I ask you is because we actually have an example from last year, the last Oscars, where you had a production, which a documentary, No Other Land, went and won the Oscar that year. And what we've seen since then, I mean, there at the time, there were hopes that this would shine a light more on the Palestinian cause. I mean, it was in the West Bank, it was not in Gaza, but still, you know, shine a light on the Palestinian cause, on the Palestinian people, on what Palestinians face in the West Bank with settlers and all of that. And yet since then, what we saw one of the co-directors get beaten by settlers. We saw one of the people that actually helped, an activist who helped the crew to film in different areas, get shot and killed by a settler. And then we saw Basil Adra, who's one of the main co-directors on the film. His house was raided just not too long ago, actually. The reason why I list all of these things is because there was still a bit of a silence. I mean, I remember when the movie won the Oscar, there was, you know, there was encouragement, and then people were like happy for it. And you had all these liberals, different, you know, stars in Hollywood speak out in favor of that film winning. And yet there was still quite a silence. You had these Oscar winners face all of these different threats or face all these different assaults. And yet nobody kind of came to their defense, even vocally. And I list all of this because I want to get your thoughts on, let's say, the voice of Hind Rajab goes and wins an Oscar. Do you really think that it could have some meaningful change, not necessarily on the ground, but within people's minds or within different circles?
Well, I hope we reach the Oscar. That would be a big thing, like for the movie. And I hope, yeah, like, I can't expect the future, but I hope it will bring a change, because that's the purpose of the movie, to make a change. And to tell Hind's story, mainly, also, like, what happened to her, to this child. All I hope, it's going to open more eyes, like, from all around the world. And the Oscar is in America. It's a... We have millions of people living there. And if we succeed to show the movie to the people, that would be great. I don't know what will happen, but all I hope is for the best. Like, it would be great if we reach to the Oscar.
But what
you know, I can't expect, I'm like, I'm an actor, like, I can't really expect, I can't know if it's gonna reach. If it's going to reach to the last stage.
Yeah.
But if it does, that would be amazing. It's like you're talking about one of the biggest awards in the world. Like, this is the reality. And all I'm hoping, like, I don't want to tell the people, like, just go and watch, like, without... Don't read about the movie. Just go you yourself as a... audience, just sit in the cinema, watch the movie, after the movie, take it in, process it, and think what it should happen. What can you do as a human being toward the humanity?
Yeah. You know, I asked you several times, really, several variations during this interview about how you've been looking back from the time you started, from the time you started filming till this moment. But let me ask you, and this will be my last question, actually, but let me ask you about how you're seeing Mu'taz after this. Where does Mu'taz go from here?
Whoa, I didn't thought of that. I see, I haven't been really thinking, just like, you know, I would love to really sit down and think of myself. And I really mean it. Like, I would love to really sit down and think, just like, what did you do? What did you do? What happened? What's going to happen? But every time I'm trying even to think about this, like, you just pop up something on the news, you forget about yourself and you only think about the people. I would love to sit with myself and really think about where I'm going now, what will happen. You're hearing a lot of great things that I'm telling you, like from distributors, producers, directors, these telling you good things about the future will be this and that for you as an actor and as a career. Which is amazing to hear it as an actor, but like I'm telling you, like I didn't have the time like really to sit with myself and like really just think about this. Like since the premiere, I've been just traveling yeah. and talking about the movie with the audience, do a Q&A from a festival to another, from cinema to another. And normally you go for some, when you do a movie, you do some festival, you do some screening and that's it. But with this movie, like the responsibility is bigger, is way bigger than anything I've done before. And I repeat this again, this is one of like the biggest honor of my life as an artist is that I played the role of Omar Alkom in The Voice of Hind Rajab to tell Hind's story. This is the biggest honor of my career, if I'm being realistic. And I'm grateful. I'm super grateful for the festivals that are honoring us, honoring the story, awarding the story, and for Kauthar for having me on set there, and for every one of them, like, the love I had on this set is beyond my imagination, and it's like something I can't even express.
And I genuinely hope that people, everybody listening, everyone watching, that, you know, for them to really go watch this project. I really do.
I hope
so. And Mataz, honestly, thank you for taking the time to come and sit with us.
Thank you for having me here.
No, absolutely. No, this was a pleasure. Thank you for coming on Real Talk, Mataz. You.